Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, the Beach.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Here we go with show number 3,317. Is that correct? No, it just seems like that. Thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us on the show tonight. Sorry for that little background noise there. I don't know if folks can hear that, but I think I probably, it's not an upgrade. I'm just supposed to switch to start using Skype instead of my cell phone there. You can use cell phone, of course, mobile, but you can put Skype on your computer. I'm still a little hesitant. I think I mentioned that last week about Skype again. I know everybody uses it, and I see people using it all the time. But I think the last time I used it, I mentioned I got calls from people all over the world in the middle of the night who I don't know, so I don't need that. But anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. And I was looking at some of the political shows that are on there as we enter or do we ever escape the political season with the presidential election coming up in less than a year now. It's going to be interesting to see how much goes on there. But, boy, if you want to study politics, there are an arm length of radio shows on Blog Talk Radio that you can listen to all kinds of political news from every perspective that you desire. Well, yes, I am your host, Keith Haley. Thanks, Johnny Cash. Thank him again for taking us on that nice trip. I hope Johnny wasn't frightened yesterday if he was out there and the trucker had his radio on, and we had the FEMA, Homeland Security National Alert, first time that all TV, all cable, all radio, all local, everything was plugged in. They want to add cell phones and everything else. At 2 p.m., you were supposed to hear a and then some kind of a message, and I guess people heard all sorts of different things across the country, meaning I don't think it was successful. And a lot of civil libertarians would say, good. Of course, we would need to be notified if something serious happened, but maybe we should wait for it to happen and then notify everybody. But who knows? I'm not an expert on Homeland Security, whatever that is. Okay. Purpose of our show is what it always is, discuss news issues and events and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Tonight is going to be a very interesting show. If you don't know anything about street gangs, Tom Diaz is going to talk to us about his book, No Boundaries, Transnational Latino Gangs in American Law Enforcement. And he's presenting this at the California Gang officers, Law Enforcement Officers Association, and kind of an interesting thing. So many gangs, we couldn't count them, but there are some big ones, and he'll talk about some of those major ones as soon as he gets done with his introductions with everybody. But what we do on this show is we dedicate it to those tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the U.S., and indeed throughout the world. They do that too. We look inside the practice of criminal justice and take a close-up look at its professionals. And Alvin Levy, we want to always pay tribute to him. He is the CEO of Blog Talk Radio, and he is, as I say, the genius behind the medium. And talk about success. I mean, it started with one show, I think, and literally thousands now that you can listen to and get the archived results if you would like to play them later for some type of interest group or class or whatever. But you can get your own show. Any group, any person, any organization can have their own show broadcast live in streaming audio worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. All of those are important. And guess what it costs? Absolutely nothing. Nothing. It's free. Just unbelievable. And if this isn't one of the top media executives in the world, I don't know what it would take to be a top media executive for Alvin Levy. Shows are archived immediately for replay if you want to do that. And all right, here we go. Away we go. You can listen on your computer as you're doing. You can listen on your cell phone. The number you call in if you want to do that during the news segment would be 347-996-5983. 347-996-5983. Audrey, do you have a blonde joke tonight? I know Lucy does the jokes, but you found this joke for tonight. You told me you like this one. Okay, we'll have Lucy, of course. Lucy, of course, just got in 3-4 weeks ago from London, England. And Lucy's now doing our blonde joke. And, Lucy, what's this one about tonight? Can you let us know? Here we go. I think here we go. Yes, here we go. Here we go.
During late spring 1 year, a blonde was trying out her new boat. She was unable to have her boat perform, travel through water, or do any maneuvers whatsoever, no matter how hard she tried. After trying for over 3 days to make it work properly, she decided to seek help. She punted the boat over to the local marina in hopes that someone there could identify her problem. Workers determined that everything from the engine to the outdrive was working perfectly on the top side of the boat. So, a puzzled marina employee jumped into the water to check underneath the boat for problems. Because he was laughing so hard, he came up choking on water and gasping for air. Under the boat, still trapped in place securely, was the trailer.
All right, that is a good one. Okay, I don't know if we've heard that one before. I'm not sure. It's, you know, I've looked through lots of these blonde jokes in the past, and Audrey, of course, has the world's largest collection of blonde jokes. Her book is forthcoming. Audrey England and Blonde Jokes. And Lucy, maybe Audrey, maybe you would have Lucy join her join you as a co-author. I think that would be interesting. But I like that one. That's a good joke. Okay, the next thing we like to do in this very serious time when crime is at almost an all-time low, but it seems to be going up in some places. I saw for the mayor of Detroit, homicides were up 19%. Maybe we talked about this news story last week, and he was telling us how well they're doing up there. The other violent crimes are down, though. You got murder, robbery, rape, aggravated assault. Those are your violent crimes, and burglary, larceny, motor vehicle theft, and arson. But I'm not thinking if your homicide rate's up 19%, I'm not sure things are going real well because the other three are down. Which one of those crimes would you fear the most? I think it might be homicide. But anyway, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms would like us to play this public service announcement in order that the criminals may hear this announcement and go down and turn in their guns.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and it certainly is a deadly idea. Well, a little green tip tonight. I thought I'd just sort of randomly pick one tonight, and we're still working from Esma Floyd's little book called 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, Small Changes to Create a Greener, Eco-Friendly World. That's by Esma Floyd, E-S-M-E-F-L-O-Y-D, if you want to check into that. And here's the tip for tonight. Use what you got. Did you hear that, Mike? Use what you got. Before rushing to the store to stock up on school supplies after summer's over, take a look at what you've got left from the previous school year. Don't double up on anything, and I suppose that would be true of almost any activity we're involved in, right? If you got something, don't get something new to replace it until you get rid of what you got. Very, very savvy, very savvy. Thank you very much, Esma, for that great book tip. A green tip. All right, let's take a look at some news. I won't spend a lot of time on news tonight because I want you to hear more about this gang story. And their introduction is a little bit long, but there's some great news stories out there tonight, and I guess the first one I should just take care of and resolve is please do not worry about the Christmas tree tax that was supposed to come about. Early this week, they announced that the federal government, I guess the Department of Agriculture, was going to place a tax on a 15-cent tax, not percent, 15-cent tax on every Christmas tree that would be sold this season in America. And you know what the purpose is? And I'm using the quote from their line. The purpose is to improve the image and marketability of Christmas trees. I'm not kidding. Stop laughing, Mike. I'm not kidding. They want to improve the image. What, the Christmas trees, they're losing their image? What, they don't comb their hair or something in the morning or what? What are they talking about? Anyway, I guess the nation rose up and there was so much jokes and laughter and resistance to the whole idea that the government finally decided that they would not do this. And they just decided this, I think, day before or yesterday, I think, was when they actually decided that they wouldn't tax our Christmas trees. I mean, I know you couldn't believe it. Supreme Court heard an interesting case yesterday. If you follow that, and you can go to oyez.org, and you can hear all the Supreme Court presentations, and they're stacked for years back. You can hear the justices talk. We've played some of them on Blog Talk Radio before, but it's a wonderful resource for professors in classes that might be referring to a particular law case. They can go back 20 years and hear the case or part of the case being presented. But anyway, should police be allowed to affix an electronic tracking device on a suspect's car without a warrant and follow this person follow their movement around for over a month? That's the case that was heard. And in this particular case, they presented testimony. They're saying, well, you know, this is a new technology age. How could the Fourth Amendment be relevant to this particular thing since they didn't have it? And it violates others. Come back and say, on the other side of that, it's the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and that we should have the right to, they should have to get a warrant to track that. Anyway, they heard the case, and people are wondering how they're going to rule in this particular case. A ruling for Jones in this case wouldn't require an end to GPS tracking. All it would mean is that the police would have to obtain a warrant before using a device that the framers of the Fourth Amendment never could have even conceived of. Well, there's a lot of things. Automobiles, for one. We have all kinds of search and seizure law that applies to autos, too, and trucks and whatever, moving vehicles. But anyway, it will be interesting how they rule on that. This is kind of an interesting thing. In Florida prisons, they've actually started a, in Milton, they've actually started a program where they take all the, or not all, but those that volunteer, I think, and they're selected, who are military veterans who have committed crimes. In other words, they've been in recent Afghanistan and Iraq and all over the place. And they're putting them all together, and they're living in kind of like a military setting, military barracks. And they get up in the morning, and everything has to be cleaned up, of course. They have to wear uniforms, and the uniforms have to be kept squared away, like you're in the military, pressed and all that business. They have a flag ceremony and raising and lowering in the morning and evening. And a couple of the guys that are interviewed in this particular news article said, you know, they really like it. It's now 49 prisoners, I guess, that are in this special veterans dormitory. Kind of an interesting idea. We've tried about everything. I guess you couldn't wear, could you wear saggers? No, I guess you couldn't wear saggers anymore if you're in that military unit, but kind of interesting. This next one makes me so mad, my ears are emitting steam or smoke, but after successfully winning a two-year prison sentence against the U.S. Border Patrol agent, remember, Jesus Diaz, he's the guy that took the 15-year-old kid that was a Mexican drug smuggler who came across the border with a bunch of smugglers. He was carrying a bag with marijuana in it, and they found all kinds of marijuana there with these particular guy. This guy was resisting arrest or custody, and so he cuffed him and he picked him up. It's sort of a technique to get him resistant, put him down on the ground and put his knee in his back. This young man, this 15, had no bruises. He had no bleeding whatsoever, no marks on his body whatsoever. He was just taking this person into custody. And there were two internal investigations carried out by the Border Patrol, and they found nothing wrong. They did a third investigation. They said, well, he probably violated something in the policy manual, something like that. But two internal reviews cleared him of any wrongdoing. Anyway, Mexico complained. A third review did say that Agent Diaz violated rules when he twisted the suspected smuggler's arms and placed his knee to apply pressure to the man. How terrible to twist his arms to get him into custody, right? But anyway, he did that. And Mexico insisted that he be prosecuted in our district court. You know they had contact with the Attorney General of the United States. But in Southern Texas, they decided to try this guy, this Border Patrol agent, Diaz, and he just went to prison for 2 years. Now, guess what the article is really about? Now they're fining his wife $6,870, saying it should be paid immediately, even though the judge signaled she would have a grace period. Can you believe that? This guy, if there's ever a cause that I would contribute some money to, if people want to appeal this, his confinement is under appeal. I would certainly do it for this. But can you believe this? What is the impact on Border Patrol agents, young, old, or in between, on the border when they find out they're taking people into custody who are drug smugglers and they're resisting arrest and you have to stop them from resisting? What in the world would you do now? I think, you know, some of them, they won't because they're professionals, but, you know, you could justify looking the other way, could you? Oh, there's a bunch of drug smugglers. Heck with it. I don't want to go to prison. If they resist arrest, you know, I could get in trouble for that. But anyway, that's something else. Here's kind of an interesting one I bet you can't believe. The crime was once considered rare. You know what we're talking about? This is where drivers are assaulted by people who spit on them. They've now had something like, what is it? They've had 88 cases or something in the last whatever. But anyway, these people go. This one guy goes out, I guess like every day when he goes off the bus, he spits on that. They're happening about 14 times a month now where passengers spit on the driver. And so guess what their solution is? They're now going to issue DNA kits to the drivers. The MTA is considering a DNA initiative. Pattern after one in Boston, with every driver getting a kit to collect samples. This opens up the package, swabs the area, says John Jay College of Criminal Justice forensic expert Lawrence Kublinski. He told Connor. So now they'll swab the area, and they'll try to find out the name of the. They'll turn this into the DNA database, and they'll try to match it up with the name so they can go out and arrest the piece. Is that maybe a little much? And other people are saying, why should we be spending money for that? Why couldn't we put the drivers inside of a petition, a little barrier of glass or something like that? Or, but why couldn't we have surveillance cameras and get pictures of these people? But they're considering collecting DNA to solve these incredible spitting crimes. I doubt that there's a cop that's been around very long that hasn't been spit on once or twice. Sometimes it's Border Patrol. I mean, it's drunks. They get spit on all the time. I'm not going to comment tonight on the Penn State case. And it's just a horrendous thing. I've read about every article that's come out about it, but you read about it. Sheriff Joe Paterno got fired today. The university president got fired. And this is the case where either they cover up or weren't smart enough to, I think, sounds like a cover-up. They didn't bring to the attention of the police these sexual assaults on these young boys in the Pennsylvania State Athletic Facility. Just an incredible case. And Joe Paterno, I mean, he's, 84 years old now, I think? Been a coach for 60 years? I forget how long he's been at Penn State, but it'll be interesting to see how that one churns out. Terrible, terrible thing. Okay, that's it. I think we're going to switch now, go listen to Tom Tierras, and he is a Washington-based journalist and lawyer, and the name of his book is No Boundaries, and the Transnational Latin Gangs and American Law Enforcement. If you know anything about gangs, this would be a good start. Most people know zip about gangs, and they're, gangs are everywhere. They're in prison. They're out of prison. They're in both places. And I think you'll enjoy this if you don't know anything about them. Here we go.
And now Tom Diaz talks about the rise of Latin gangs in the U.S., like MS-13, and how law enforcement is reacting. He spoke in Anaheim, California. Our next speaker, our keynote speaker for this conference, is Tom Diaz, and I mentioned the book earlier, No Boundaries, and I've read it, and I think it's excellent. And if you're working MS-13, 18th Street, and if you're in any Latino gang, I think it's a must-read. So when I read it, I asked Tom if he'd come out and do this and give some insight from a non-law enforcement perspective, looking at law enforcement and how we work with them. And he's been all over the country looking for, at this. Tom's written several books on terrorism, or a book on terrorism, and other books. He's also an attorney. His home base is out of Washington, D.C. We've known each other for a good few years. We've talked about gangs for a long time. Tom? Thank you, Wes. I'm deeply honored, and Wes McBride did not write this part. I'm deeply honored that Wes McBride and the California Gang Investigators Association invited me to speak here today. Wes mentioned that I've talked to a lot of people across the country and researching my book, and just about every gang investigator I met either knew or had heard of or had learned something from Wes McBride. I had the pleasure of meeting him about 12 years ago when I was working with an independent television producer, and she was working on a documentary about gangs in the military, and I met Wes then, and I also met ATF supervisory agent now, Rich Marianas, I think, has left. Nothing has changed. The military said it didn't have a problem with gangs then, and it says it doesn't have a problem now. I think Barbara's documentary showed 12 years ago that it was different. The full title of my book, if you're interested, is No Boundaries, Transnational Latino Gangs and American Law Enforcement. When I talk about the book, I just call it No Boundaries, Except yesterday when I was checking in, somebody asked me, what's the title of your book? And I couldn't remember any of it. It was like the white coat effect. I came to this conference 3 years ago. I was hoping to get an interview with Wes, and I didn't realize how busy he was. He had told me graciously, come on out. So I got about 2 minutes. It was a very pleasant 2 minutes, and he said, well, come back when I'm not so busy, and I did. I had a very long and interesting conversation with him. Another person I actually did meet in an interview in 2006 when I came out here was Bruce Reardon. Bruce is now the director of anti-gang operations for the city attorney of Los Angeles. In 2006, when I came out of here, he was an assistant United States attorney in Los Angeles, and he had just, within recent time, won a landmark federal racketeering case against the 18th Street Gang, the Columbia Little Psychos clique, and they were doing extortion in the environs of MacArthur Park under the command of Frank Puppet Martinez, who was a member of the Mexican Mafia prison gang. It's been said before, and I'll say it briefly, but Wes and Bruce and Rich all represent this team effort that's necessary. Wes mentioned from the point of view of an outsider looking at gangs and law enforcement to get at this problem. They don't agree on everything, and sometimes they disagree. I don't know of anything you can think of that Wes McBride agrees with entirely every single item of it. He's an independent man. Well, I talked about Bruce Reardon, and when I walked into his office, something struck me. He had one of these sitting on a table in his office. I may not be the smartest lawyer in Washington, and I may not be the best journalist in America, but I figured there was a story behind it. This is a pith helmet. It's the kind of pith helmet that was worn by soldiers in the British Empire in the late 19th century, when the British Empire was in its glory, and they used to say, the sun never sets on the Union Jack, meaning that the British flag was flying somewhere in the world. Well, as I said, there is a story about this helmet and about Bruce, and it relates to you, but I'm going to put this away for now and tell that story a little bit later. I'm not a gang expert. You're the gang expert. I'm a writer. No Boundaries is not an academic work. It's not a textbook on sociology, psychology, ethnology, or criminology. It's not an encyclopedia of Latin gangs, Latino gangs. And it's not a handbook for investigators. There are very good books like that that I've read, and they're available, some of them on the website of the CTIA, written by a couple of gang detectives in Orange County. William Dunn's got a fine book about the history of the gangs of Los Angeles. But what my book, No Boundaries, is, it's a work of journalism, and it's of a specific type called narrative nonfiction. It tells real stories about real people and real cases. I aim to describe through these stories the story of the traumatic birth, the turbulent growth, and the violent criminal activity of the major transnational Latino criminal gangs and the response of you all, American law enforcement, to those gangs. Now, whatever else No Boundaries may be or how it may be described, it's a sort of travelogue. It's a journey into an exceedingly violent gang, an exceedingly violent land within a land. That violent land is one which most Americans, and unfortunately some in law enforcement, are only vaguely aware of. They know it's out there. They don't like it. They're properly frightened by it, but they don't know the details of it, and they don't understand it. And I hope to communicate through No Boundaries some of the texture of the Latino gang world. I want to take you on a tour of that land from my perspective today, and I want to talk about five subjects: change, carnage, culture, character, and challenge, the five C's. I was thinking about having four C's and a V, the V being violence instead of carnage. It sounded like a doo-wop group, which probably ages me. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the four C's and a V. Wes suggested that I talk a little bit about how I came to write No Boundaries and then get into the substance. Well, 4 years ago, I finished the book that Wes referenced, which I also wrote, co-authored with Barbara Newman, about a Lebanese terrorist group called Hezbollah and its operations in the United States, and that book was called Lightning Out of Lebanon. I was looking around for something else to write about, and the senior official of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington told me, why don't you look at these Latino gangs, and particularly MS-13? Because at that time, they had ranked gangs violence as number one on their worries about violent crime in America, and MS-13 was on the top of the list. It was no coincidence that right about that time the FBI started their MS-13 National Gang Task Force, and I was fortunate to get an extremely good public affairs representative by the name of Angela Bell, who helped me through that part of it. However, when I started looking into the subject of gangs, I was really hooked on it. I thought it was important and interesting. But there were two obstacles I faced. The first is there are a lot of different kinds of Latino gangs and their subsets, sometimes called cliques or cliques. They range from little organisms that belong in a single block, or for those of you who are from suburban or rural areas, maybe a little area, through the regional gangs that operate across large states or several states, to the big transnational gangs like MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang, which were both born here in Los Angeles. But it's worth noting that at every level, whether you're talking about the street gang or the gang that operates across the Western Hemisphere, all these gangs confront society with one fundamental question. And that question is, who's in charge here? Who controls this turf? Is it the legitimate government or is it the gangsters? Well, there's no way I could write about all these gangs, so I decided to focus on MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang for two reasons. First, I think they both embody what people call the California gang style or the California gang culture, especially as it exists today, because they were both born here. They both developed in ways I'll talk about later. The other characteristic of this gang is that they both operate transnationally. There's some debate about how well organized they are, but they are at least loosely organized across international borders, and they conduct crime across those borders. That's where the book's title came from, No Boundaries. I also wanted to show the variety of Latino gangs and how they differ among themselves. So I wrote research, and I wrote about the original Latin kings in Chicago. They call Chicago their motherland. And I went to Miami, Florida, several times because the natural reaction I had and many people have is Miami, big Latino city, they must have a lot of Latino gang problems. And I got some very interesting and different perspectives down there, which I write about in the book. There are other little gangs, or other Latino gangs play cameo roles throughout No Boundaries. My second big obstacle is you all, because law enforcement people are notoriously, or perhaps notorious is not the best word, but closed-mouthed, especially about talking to writers. Some of that's completely understandable. If you're working on a case now, you don't want to jeopardize the investigation or the prosecution. Some of you have been burned. Some of you just don't feel comfortable talking to civilians or outsiders. But I learned that an introduction from one police officer to another or one agent to another is essential, often to get doors open. Sometimes the doors aren't open. Sometimes they're open and shut. But most importantly, the stories behind those doors. Over a period of time, I was able to develop a network of, I think, several score people in law enforcement, and I was able to gain enough confidence of these people that I was allowed to attend an international anti-gang conference in El Salvador in 2007. The conference is held, to my knowledge, they still do it every year. The Salvadoran Civil Police and the FBI are the major sponsors of that gang, of that conference, where I learned some very interesting things from the international perspective. Research is the biggest part of writing a book. People often ask me, how long did it take you to write the book? Well, the research is the biggest part. And I spent about 3 years researching the gangs. The sources I used, first and most important, people in law enforcement, people like you. Second, and I think this is largely overlooked by journalists and other researchers, the actual records of criminal cases. I examined in detail a number of criminal cases, and then I read books, magazine articles. No one has written down the knowledge, and I don't think they could write down all the knowledge that resides in the minds of gang investigators, prosecutors, other people like you all, Wes McBride, Bruce Reardon. So the best you can hope to do is to mine out of there a perspective. Well, out of all these sources, I arrived at the five themes that I wanted to talk about today. I was in the military and they used to say, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And it's change, carnage, culture, character, and talent. So I'll start with change. The biggest constant of Latino gangs is change. The gangs are a product of change around them. They're changing themselves, and law enforcement has changed. We heard some of that earlier. So the most important question from my point of view that you might ask today, during this week of training here, is not only what is, it's what is going to be. What does the future hold? In the same way that Southern California, Houston, Texas, Washington, D.C., Miami, Florida, Chicago are not the same today as they were in 1940 or 1950, the Latino gangs are not the same today as they were when in the California interest. Example, some of them started in a minor way in the 20s, really took off in the 40s. They're different. They're different from when they were in the 50s. They're different from how they were in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. Even in the 90s, there are some differences that you can see. And, of course, law enforcement has changed, too. Now, the big transnational institutionalized Latino gangs didn't just fall out of the sky. And they're not just a random collection of bad boys who would become angelic and productive citizens if we just smack them around enough or hug them enough. They are the product, and they mark really fast changes that have swept over our society, the United States, and the world over the last several decades. For example, wars in Central America, which I don't think anybody in the 1980s, I was in Central America in 1985, had the foresight to think through, well, what's that going to mean domestically in the United States, aside from the many demonstrations that were going on there again? Well, if you look at the history of Madre Salvatrucha, MS-13, about a million Salvadoran immigrants ended up in different places, big concentrations in the Los Angeles area, big concentrations in the Washington, D.C. area, the two areas where, for a complex of reasons that I describe in No Boundaries, a gang named Mara Salvatrucha grew up, was born. Another factor, the big Chicano Pride movement prompted at least some authorities think a gang, the Clanton gang, to say, you know what, if you can't prove that your blood is, you know, pure Mexican blood, we don't want you in our gang. So a bunch of Latinos who couldn't show that they were necessarily of pure Mexican heritage, formed another gang. They called it the 18th Street Gang. In the inimitable words of Los Angeles Police Department gang detective Frank Flores, I'll clean it up a little bit, they were getting their butt kicked. So they said, you know what, we'll open the books. Anybody can join our gang. And the gang grew, it became huge. This all happened within the last 20 years. So those forces are unpredictable. Wars, other forces that we can talk about that are really at the guts of our political life today, and we've heard reference to them. The changes that I write about and talk about, economic restructuring in the United States and the world, something we call globalization, immigration patterns that define national borders and ignore immigration laws, transnational crime, and the federalization and growing internationalization of law enforcement. These changes today force us as a people to face issues that are sometimes very divisive, but they're at the core of why these Latino gangs exist in the form that they do today. One of the biggest of these changes was a fundamental change in the American economy. In less than a single lifetime, the lifetime of maybe your parents or grandparents, certainly my parents, the face of the American worker changed from basically the factory worker to what we call an associate in the service and information industry. It wasn't just in the Rust Belt. The factories didn't just close, you know, in Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Chicago. There were factories in Southern California that made cars and sheet glass. Those all disappeared, and then we became, you have to be a computer scientist or you push hamburgers across the counter. Those all things changed. And you add to this a change that Chief Bratton referred to, the proliferation of semi-automatic high-capacity firearms, and the rise of the lucrative drug industry, the most profitable business in the world. You add all that together, and you've got, in the case of Latino gangs, a really harsh crucible. They were transformed, and they were hardened during this period. They went from what they were in the 40s, to some extent even into the 50s, they were called fighting gangs. Some people even called them tomato gangs. They were called tomato gangs because they'd get into fights and they would steal the tomatoes from the vegetable carts and throw them at each other and get to these food fights, in effect. That all changed. They became violent, and they became over time. Members of gangs went to prison, primarily for drug purposes. Prisons became institutions of education, and the gangs hardened. They became rooted in the community. There were all kinds of changes in the 40s, but these changes economically had the following impact, particularly for immigrants. It used to be it didn't matter whether you spoke Hungarian, English, German, French, Italian, Spanish. If you could get a job in a factory and the foreman could show you what to do, you could do that. That was a rung on a ladder that you pulled yourself and your family up in. When the manufacturing jobs disappeared, it became much harder. Now, I'm not saying that these are the only reasons that gangs exist, because they existed before this, but I'm saying it had a major impact on how gangs hardened and the alternative for the gang members. The chasm between the office suite and the hot food counter at McDonald's or you name your fast food place became just too far to leave if you couldn't get a handle on the industrial ladder. That was true for all young people. We're still dealing with that problem today. And then there's something that we call globalization. The jobs went offshore and sweatshops came onshore. That affected not just gangsters, but all youth, but gangsters are gone from the pool of youth who are affected most directly by these economic trends. Other things, global transportation, communications network, and technology. The transnational criminal organizations, especially but not exclusively the drug trade, exploit these changes. They're very adaptive. They move very quickly, and they have the funds to get to them. They seize upon the gangs as natural connectors. Wherever you're from, if you have gangs, they are natural places for these bigger transnational organized crime groups to plug in, and sometimes they provide useful muscle. Migration changed all of this also. Today, almost any migration dream is feasible. Whether you're talking about China, whether you're talking about Central America, whether you're talking about the Middle East, migration is feasible, and it's as close as the nearest snakehead or coyote or human smuggler. So that's all changed, and that's all presented an obvious problem. The gangs continue to change. They are not static. They're not little mechanical devices that wind up. If you could just smash that one gear, they would stop. We could freeze them up. I discussed in No Boundaries, people often say Southern California is the epicenter of gangs. Epicenter is a term we use in when we talk about earthquakes. And it's a mechanical term. The epicenter is, you know, that point right above where the earthquake, boom, pieces fall down. But it implies a kind of mechanical relationship. Big piece of rock falls, things radiate, buildings fall down. I say gangs are not like that. Gangs are made up of human beings. They're organic. They learn. They adapt. They exploit the world around them as it changes. And they watch what you do, and they learn from what you do. So the gang of yesterday is not the gang of today, and the gang of tomorrow is not going to be the gang of today. There's a professor named Max Manwaring at the U.S. Army War College who's written about this evolution of gangs, and he talks about generations of gangs. The first generation were the barrio gangs. And unfortunately, a lot of people today romanticize these gangs as if that was a period, all the sweetness and love and ethnic community. But then he contrasts that with the development of what he calls the third generation gangs. And the third generation gangs are the gangs we're talking about today, MS-13 and 18th Street gangs, who have connections to major criminal groups who are heavily armed and who really only are about criminal profit. I talked about sweatshops earlier, sweatshops coming on board. In my opinion, the world's biggest sweatshop today is the trade in illegal drugs. Gangster life sells itself, and you see this out on the streets, to its young recruits as a refuge. The gang is portrayed as a brotherhood that provides family, respect, and glamour. In reality, the gang life is bloody, sordid, dangerous, and poisonous, and a tool of exploitation. Many gangs today, especially the bigger gangs, are really nothing more than violent criminal enterprises in drag. They wear the clothes of the barrio, they speak the language, but in reality, they practice the life of traditional organized crime. The clever and ruthless few, the shot callers, the big homies, who seize the leadership of these gangs, enjoy wealth and enormous profits. In the case of Bruce Reardon prosecuted, they found a cardboard box with $500,000 of cash in Frank Puppet Martinez's mother-in-law's closet. That was just something that was there when they executed the major search warrants. But the loyal, poorly compensated foot soldiers of these enterprises, the rank-and-file gang members, are really, in effect, slaves. Here's what they're enslaved by. They're enslaved by deeply rooted concepts in the Latino community of manhood, pride, and loyalty to one's barrio, and in the case of the gang, to homies. The gang number, MS-13, 18th Street, and the colors are, in effect, invisible chains. And if these either serve to provide the violent muscle through which the criminal enterprise asserts its control over whatever the market is, drugs, human trafficking, and disciplines those who participate in it. So when you think about it, maybe the gangsters aren't toiling in garment industry sweatshops, but they're toiling in the biggest sweatshop of all, the drug industry sweatshop. Now, if you look at some of these gangs and the cases, as I have, we'll talk a little bit more about, most of the Latino gangs have adopted the familiar model of traditional organized crime. That means extortion, smuggling, opportunistic crime of any sort, and the development of skills and assets, networks, that can be plugged in and used as needed. A gang extortion that I write about and I've seen most, it takes the form of so-called taxation. Sometimes they call it renta, and in Texas I think they call it dangling. Taxation of drug dealers. But they also extort people who sell tacos from vending stands or whatever opportunity there is. Drugs just happens to be the most lucrative. There was an impressive indictment that was handed up last month in Los Angeles of MS-13, and that indictment, if you get a chance to read it, lays out in detail, in the case of MS-13 and the Mexican Mafia, how the taxing scheme works. The clica, the local gang, taxes the drug dealers. They have a whole hierarchy, and then some of that goes to the Mexican Mafia. Now, you all know better than I do how law enforcement has changed generally and in response to gangs specifically, so I won't dwell on that topic, but I will talk about two things that I write about in the book. The first is the general path of reform of law enforcement agencies really over the last century. If you look at the history of police agencies in particular, 100 years ago, they were widely recognized as the corrupt tools of basically political bosses. If you haven't gone online and read the Los Angeles Police Department official history, I would suggest you do it because they're very candid about what things were like 100 years ago in police agencies. But that's all changed. And now we have the professional, highly trained organizations that you all represent. And part of that development and training has been learning about gangs and reacting to gangs in different ways. The Los Angeles Police Department used to deal with the Latino gang problem in the 1940s is they had a few what they called Mexican officers, and they'd send them down into barrios whenever things got out of order. Then there were some cataclysmic events that happened in Los Angeles, and the police had to change the way they dealt with it. So we went through a whole history of different ways of dealing with gangs. The Los Angeles Police Department was credited with, you know, the first model of a gang unit. The other remarkable change is the involvement of federal law enforcement. In the early 1990s, people in Washington dismissed gang crime. They call it street crime. And many agencies said, we're not going to get our highly trained professional agents involved in street crime. That's something that's only appropriate for basically street cops. Well, events in the early 1990s changed that, and I write about them in some detail. There were a couple of them. There was a huge riot in Los Angeles. It happened to be during the presidential election year. Some people call it the Rodney King riot. But one of the fallouts of that riot was that it was seen that gang members were intimately involved in a lot of the violence, a lot of the pillage, a lot of the theft of farms. And surprisingly enough, it's often thought as an African-American riot. Really, later and after it was determined that the bulk of the organized violence was done by Latino gangs. Now, that sort of got the federal government's attention in a preliminary way. And there were other things going on at the same time, the so-called crack epidemic. But the point is that over the last 15 years, the federal government has become much more intimately involved in the fact that it was discussed here today, ATF, FBI, DEA, ICE, they all have some kind of program, and they're all part of the team concept and the racketeering concept that the federal government brings to the table. Well, I talked about these historical, social, economic forces that shape the Latino gang. And one way, however, as interesting as all those forces are, they don't matter. They don't matter because you, as law enforcement officers, have to deal with the gang as it is today. You have to deal with the gangster as he, or in some cases, she is today. It doesn't matter what the forces are. That's interesting to know and have to understand in more depth, but you have to deal with gangsters as they are today. So let's talk a little bit about what they are. If I could send one postcard from a gangland that I looked at in the course of researching that book, it would have two words on it. And those two words would be heartless violence. Because the plain truth emerges from the records of the case that I looked at, that this is what street gangs, and in particular these transnational Latino gangs, ultimately do. They are relentlessly and consistently violent. Violence is simply what they do in real life. Now, there are many reasons that they do violence. Internal discipline, territorial control, obscure rivalries, revenge, something called respect. Gang life may and does include hours of ethnic and brotherly bonding. There are nights and days of chemically assisted partying when nothing much goes on, you just hang out. And there are weeks of just restless being around. They creep by. But sooner or later, in the land of the gangs that I write about, violence erupts. The bloody assault, the brutal murder, and the casual death of innocent bystanders. One of the two people I dedicated my book to was such an innocent bystander in Chicago. Her name was Ana Mateo. Her family was a model of Mexican immigration to the United States. Legal, hardworking, building a new and productive life in Chicago's Tilton neighborhood. Some of you may not know it's the largest Latino community east of Los Angeles. Ana Mateo was 7 years old when she was struck in the back of the head by a 9mm bullet. It was fired two blocks away by a 16-year-old gangster named Juan Garcia. He was a member of a gang in Chicago called the Latin Counts. And Garcia was chasing a guy down the street who he thought mistakenly was a member of another gang. Pop, pop, pop. He emptied his 9mm handgun. And moments later, little Ana Mateo died in the arms of her mother. I tell Ana's story in a chapter of my book titled A Thirst After Justice, Medical Examiner Case Number 338, because that was the number of her case. Now, there's no gang squad in any city of any size whose members can't tell similar stories. I saw stories like that everywhere. Innocent bystanders, too often children, killed, and oftentimes by stray shots. But the point is that every gangster is at least capable of that violence, because gangster culture has normalized and rationalize violence, so that being a stone killer is no longer, in that culture, a bad thing, it's a good thing. When you look at the history of gangs, particularly in Los Angeles, there used to be a thing, it was called a fair fight. When you wanted to have you had a beef with another gang member, even from another gang, what you did is you went and you called that person out. This is now up through into the 40s, maybe a little bit early in the 50s. And you fought it out. Women, children, other members of the family were off limits. It was called the fair fight. That no longer exists, obviously. I think probably everybody in this room knows. Anybody's a fair target at any occasion, the advent of the drive-by shooting. In fact, every gangster is expected expected to step up and commit violence when the shot callers or the big homies or whatever you want to call them decide that it's needed, or when respect demands revenge, or when a rivalry, some beef that nobody can even remember how it started, demands that you go out and take somebody else's life. A gang prosecutor in Chicago put it this way, you know, every now and then, somebody says, hey, this is the day when, take your name, Sarajevo got killed. Let's go out and kill somebody from that other gang. That's just what we do. I quote some testimony from the 18th Street gang that, to me, was really chilling when a guy who was ultimately convicted and was sort of a hitman for this 18th Street police talked about, you know, they were asking him, what is your gang? And he says, well, you know, they call us to do things. Sometimes it's graffiti. Sometimes it's to do a drive-by. The difference of those two things, they call it, you know, doing work for the gang. Sometimes it's graffiti. Sometimes it's killing somebody. To him, it sounded like it's the same thing. You know, sometimes I rake my yard, and sometimes I go back and shoot my neighbor. If you heard that in your community, it doesn't make sense. The gangster who refuses these invitations at best faces expulsion from the gang and probably at worst will suffer violence himself. Which brings us to the question of gangster culture. Gangster values are completely different from and fundamentally hostile to everything that we've learned about Western culture over the last several thousand years. In June 2006, I interviewed a man named Don Levine. He's a former District of Columbia Metropolitan Police officer, and he's become an FBI gang analyst and an expert on gang culture. When I interviewed Don Levine, it was a little bit disconcerting to me because I asked him, I'd read an article he'd written about gang culture, and I asked him about it, and he turned the tables on me. He started asking me questions. This is how the conversation went, paraphrased. Levine, do you have any children? Me, yeah. Levine, do you teach them values? By now I'm thinking, where is this going? Yes, I do. He says, well, just turn those values upside down and you will begin to understand the gang culture. Everything you think is good, they think is bad, and everything they think is bad, you think is good. That was an eye-opener, and at the time I thought...
We're going to have to stop it there, but... Very interesting. I think it's a book worth picking up. You can hear him talk for just 53 minutes and 53 seconds. It's Tom Diaz, and the book is called No Boundaries. And it certainly is a specialization. I had a student not too long ago in graduate school who did an oral history with a 30-plus year member of Los Angeles Police Department's gang squad. And very interesting work. A lot of people probably don't want to work in that capacity because of the potential for violence and harm, et cetera. But these are some strange characters, and those that work with them in terms of rehabilitation, that type of thing, they certainly are involved in a calling. Well, that's it for tonight. We'll ask Vera Lynn to take us off the show, as she usually does with her beautiful song, We'll Meet Again.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.